this, from the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression to the strongest economy in the world. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features meditations on black labor and the white architects of black education. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Sean Wisdom Tali. The music in the background is You've Got to Have Freedom by Pharoah Sanders. First, I just want to thank the listeners for supporting Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner today during our fall pledge drive. And also want to take this opportunity to thank all of you for supporting us last week, for reaching our goal last week. And I'm sure we can do that again today and even surpass our goal, as it's very much needed for the station as we try to go to a new facility. Our goal for this hour is $500. And to ensure that we reach the goal, call 1-800-222-9739. That's 800-222-9739. Or visit WPFWFM.org. Go to the Donate Now button, scroll down to Africa Now. And that's the WPFWFM.org. And you can also support the station and Africa Now at our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM. And make sure you write that it's for Africa Now and also put your contact information. Again, go to our Cash App, which is the $WPFW. And our goal again is $500 for this hour. The community's continued support over the years has made it possible for us to be an independent grassroots media outlet. Thus, from October 14 to November 3, we celebrate the Circle Unbroken, 47 years of being in community with WPFW during our fall pledge drive. And we invite you to continue to be in community and solidarity with us by making a donation to ensure this independent grassroots media outlet not only survives but thrives. Call 800-222-9739. That's 800-222-9739, or visit WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org, and go to the Donate Now button. And also, you can pledge your support on our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM, and its Cash App is WPFWFM, so that we can reach our goal for $500 or beyond $500 for this hour. And it is with your generous support that we build a better world, one broadcast at a time. Today we're going to our archives with a conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid, where we meditate on black labor and the white architects of black education. The discussion is centered on William H. Watkins' work, The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power, 1865 to 1954. Here is the conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope.
Labor has changed. Its production, its definition, its control. But one thing that has not changed are the parameters within which labor has been defined. its value extracted and dehumanized, mechanized, automated, artificially intelligized. What does labor mean in a settler imperial world fortified by racial, capitalist, social, political, and cultural structures that maintain a social order that places the African and African-descended worker beyond the periphery of benefiting from their labor? What about decolonizing labor and labor movements? What about a world without work? What are the ideological frameworks that, quote, labor, unquote, is using to attempt to construct the material realities of our current world? What does or will this world look like in 2 years? We used to telescope out 10, 15 years, but given the recent conditions, things are and have been happening more quickly. And what are the implications for the Africana world? What are the implications for the Earth? And now more than ever, the heavens, space. The center of questions around Black labor usually pivot on the role of Black education. However, most explorations are neither critical nor intellectually honest. Today, Dr. Kamal Rashid joins us in conversation where we meditate on Black labor and the white architects of Black education. Our thoughts are centered on William H. Watkins' work, The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power, 1865-1954. In The White Architects of Black Education, Watkins explores the body of ideas that undergird social, economic, racial, and educational beliefs about Black education in the U.S. Therefore, it's an ideological study. His stated objective is to investigate the ideological construction of colonial Black education by examining the views, politics, and practices of the white architects that funded, created, and refined it. Supporting this approach, Watkins argues that a body of ideas serves to rationalize and justify any political or economic system, but ideology helps organize our world and explains it in relation to power and vested interests. Watkins' work highlights that the white architects of Black education represented great power and wealth. Most often, they stood for the interest of Northern capital and Southern white expediency. Therefore, colonial education in the South must never be confused with the educational agenda of Blacks in the South. In fact, these agendas conflict. The central question guiding our discussion today simply asks, how far have we moved away from these foundational ideas and their ideological grounding? Dr. Kamal Rashid is currently professor and founding director of the Urban Education EDD program at Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid earned his PhD and BA from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a Master's of Art degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African-American history and culture, particularly the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. He is co-developing an oral history and archival project focused on African-American social movements in the Chicago area from 1960s to 1980s with Dr. Richard Benson of Spelman College. And he is currently working on Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, as well as the critical theory of W.E.B. Du Bois, The Struggle for Humanity. He has published a number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, as well as received various grant awards to support his work. Lastly, and likely most importantly, Dr. Rashid is active in a number of community organizations in the Chicago area, including the Comedic Institute of Chicago, a research and educational organization focused on mapping, exploring, and applying the ancient and contemporary contributions of ancient Nile Valley civilizations. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. Thank you once again for taking the time to join us today. the first program that we did was such a important intervention, particularly looking at the fighting arts and also in its expansion. And but in that conversation, you know, even when we had the conversation before, we briefly alluded to having another conversation, in particularly around a book that was written that was titled The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power in America, 1865 to 1954. And something that you said that really prompted me was like, as we were talking, he was like, I wonder what that would look like in 2020, 2021, right? You know, and in that conversation, we were saying that we wanted to have questions around this particular book, but more specifically, again, how the ideas and arguments of that book, how would they look today? Mm-hmm. And here we are today. Mm-hmm. And boy, has today expanded itself, man. You know, it there's many things that have happened, you know, particularly with you know, COVID, but particularly with a number of the hirings, particularly with the philanthropy of around HBCUs, Black education. Let's dive right in, you know.
For sure.
You know, let's dive right in. So I've been trying to figure out how to actually dive into this conversation, because I've been going back looking at Du Bois's 10 critiques. I've been looking at that in the context of decolonizing the university. I've been looking at all of these conversations, Anna Julia Cooper. I've been looking at all of these conversations and how they have really set the tone for explaining what is going on in education broadly, but then specifically with HBCUs and what is considered to be Black education. All right. So as we begin to kind of unpack, you know, all of these ideas and all of these things, let's start here. Let's start with some of the arguments that is presented by William Watkins in his book, The White Architects of Black Education. Mm-hmm. What are some of those arguments that he presents, or that is presented in that book? And then we'll kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that Watkins raises, which is very interesting, he argues that the foundational ideas or the foundational structures around Black education emerge in the wake of the Civil War, right? And so this theme of sectionalism, this theme of the reorganization of the South and the reintegration of the South, or the integration of the South, and, well, literally the reintegration of the South into industrial, northern industrial capitalism, and then finally the Negro question. Those were the three overarching concerns. And so when you had sectionalist sentiments, that is, these types of regional divisions which pervaded the United States in the 19th century, to be sure, which culminated in the Civil War. So you were talking about a divided society. On the other hand, you're talking about the fact that, you know, from the 19th century, or really, I'm sorry, from the early 19th century on, and really, you know, let's say this, the early 19th century on, and certainly from the early 19th century on, the agrarian South is a fundamental component of northern industry. I say from the 19th century on because, of course, industrialization in this country is really a 19th century phenomenon. But to be sure, if we're talking about the 17th century as well as the 18th century, to be sure, the agrarian South plays a major part in the development of the economy of the entire society. But particularly if you think about the textile industry, for instance, in New England, and the relation of that to the transportation industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry, and the myriad of cotton plantations in the American South, all these things are entwined. So again, after the Civil War, you have the reintegration of the South into that industrial capitalist framework. And finally, you have the Negro problem or the Negro question. And Watkins presents it really very, and I think in a lot of, even though he doesn't use the terms, he presents the Negro problem or the Negro question in a way very similar to the way Dr. Anderson Thompson used to talk about this. Anderson Thompson, you know, some of your listeners may know, was for many, many years a professor at Northeastern Illinois University here in Chicago. He was one of the founding members of organizations like the Comedic Institute of Chicago and the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations. And when I would take classes with him, Dr. Thompson would refer to the Negro question as follows: what is to be done about the troublesome presence of Negroes now that they are no longer needed as a source of labor? And so the Negro question, that is, what is to be done for the troublesome presence of the Black folks, was really a fundamental part of what is being done or what is being conceived and enacted in the late 19th century with respect to the formation of Black education. So those are, I think, the three salient things. And everything that Watkins does in the book really explicates how those three themes begins to manifest itself in the construction of what came to be known as Black education. Perhaps unfortunately so, to be honest.
No, and that is exactly right, because I mean, some of the themes that, you know, we can look at that you laid out that he presents in the book really centered around the question of colonial, the process of being this question of the Negro was really how, you know, as you eloquently retold it as provided by Anderson Thompson. But of course, there's a long genealogy with Du Bois. There's a long genealogy with Maria Stewart. I mean, there's a long genealogy of this, of trying to deal with this question. And the industrial North wanted, it's a labor question. How do you educate? Which is a contradiction, right? So after the Civil War, you have, you know, generally understood about 1865, right? Mm-hmm. Then of course you get 1884, 1885, the so-called Berlin Conference, the mm-hmm. scramble for Africa. Mm-hmm. In the midst of all of this is, what do you do with a force of labor? How do you educate them? And how do you subsequently, ideologically, really quell their sense for being able to resist, their sense for being able to really flourish in a society now that they're quote unquote free, mm-hmm. right? So education becomes important. And so Watkins is presenting these themes of the contestation between knowledge production and access, mm-hmm. and clearly power, mm-hmm. mixed in with the philosophical understandings of these industrialists who are also directly related to the plantation forces, mm-hmm. in Britain, that industrial class, right, mm-hmm. who have, you know, they have the right of view, they have the right of way, the right of society. Mm-hmm. So they also have the sense that, oh, we have the plan for education, which is a contestation between those in the southern part, right, who mm-hmm. the economy is moving from the agrarian economy, moving more mm-hmm. to an industrial economy. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as Anderson Thompson, as you just said, what do you do when you no longer need that labor, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, in the midst of all of this, it's HBCUs, right?
Yep. Yeah.
As the executor of all of this ideology, the contestation between power, the contestation between knowledge and access, I mean production and access, mm-hmm. you know. So, let's talk about, you know, but this. And this eventually leads to, obviously, the whole intervention of an African-centered education, the interventions of the Black University, the interventions of Africana studies and Black studies, which can be rooted into, or which we can assess in the context of this colonial education, or of this ideology that Watkins lays out in his book through biography, through mm-hmm. the ideas of these individuals. Talk about the importance of the relationship between colonial Africa, the mm-hmm. education system there, because a lot of these philanthropists and missionaries talk about mm-hmm. that particular aspect being a fundamental component, mm-hmm. as being you know, the progenitor, the development, or the origins of education here in the United States, but also, you know, HBCUs themselves. I know there's a long-winded but again, I'm thinking about this a lot, right? So
yeah.
You know, jump right in, you know, in there, you know, the relationship between that colonial, let's talk a little bit more about that, because that's very important, even up to today. It's training, training versus educating, training versus that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I guess before I talk about Watkins, that, you know, Doc, one of the things that, Dr. Greg Kamathi Carr talks about is intellectual genealogy. And one of the things that, you know, is very clear about Watkins' book is that it's in the continuum of works by people like Du Bois and certainly Carter G. Woodson. And when you were talking, I was thinking about particularly with the last point you made, I thought about Woodson and how he talked about, I think it was in his book, The Education of the Negro, from 1915, he mentions it in Miseducation of the Negro, but he talked about his experience teaching abroad and this colonial dimension. you know, one of the things I think that was important for Europeans, you know, there were three, you know, like you mentioned the term ideological weapon, and I want to center what I see around that, because I would argue there were three principal elements of types of ideological weaponry that were deployed against Africans or Black people at this time, specifically African Americans at this time. One was religion, and Watkins talks about how there's one section where he's talking about Samuel Chapman Armstrong and Hampton, and how there was a concerted effort made to facilitate the Christianization of the students, which raises a lot of interesting questions, right? If they needed to be Christianized, what were they before, right? that's a discussion for another time.
Again, that's Dr. Kamal Rashid. He's from Northeastern Illinois University, and he's the director, he's a professor and founding director of Leadership, Equity, and Inquiry and the EDD program at Northeastern Illinois University. And he's in discussion with African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope on meditations on Black labor and the white architects of Black education. And I'm your host, Muizzo Muntali, with Africa Now, and that's from our archives. And also with me in the studio is, the virtual studio is Katia Stitt, the program director here at WPFW. Welcome, Katia.
Thank you for having me, Muizzo. It's a blessing always to be with you, and such a fascinating discussion today. And of course, I love the opening of that Pharoah Saunders, "You've Got to Have Freedom," which indeed we do. And that is really what Africa Now is about, liberating the African of journalism, of the airwaves. You know, this is one way that we even the playing field, so to speak, when you have a show like Africa Now aired weekly, talking about what is happening, the salient issues facing the African continent proper and the diaspora. This is how we get free. And so if you understand the liberatory nature of this program and you have not yet pledged, we're looking for new members right now between now and the end of the pledge drive. So if you've not made that step to become a member of WPFW, then we ask you to do it now. Pledge for Africa Now. Your ears are there. Let's bring your wallet. And your heart is here. Let's bring your wallet to bear. 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect with us. We have a goal of $500, and we can do that easily, folks. If you're a new member and you're able to make a sustaining pledge at the $50 level, we will exceed the goal. Or $100 level, we will over double the goal. You may be someone who has $5 to pledge during this program, and we would happily and gratefully accept that. No amount is too large or too small. Again, we are looking for new members between now and the end of the pledge drive. And so far, along those lines, we have garnered, I'm just looking for that information, we've garnered
We still need to get some members.
We still need to get some members. We're trying to get 600 between now and the end of the pledge drive, and we've gotten so far. We still need 593. I'm sorry. So many notes, Muizzo, forgive me.
Oh, okay.
So $500 to go to pledge your support and support Africa Now. We can make this goal together. Many hands make light work is the African proverb. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. And of course, don't forget Cash App at $WPFWFM. Muizzo?
Yeah, and then as Katia mentioned, you don't have to have the like if you're donating $100, you don't have to donate all at once. You can spread it out throughout the year as a sustainer member. And if we have five people to do that, we'll make the goal. Hopefully we can have more than five people because we need to make up lost ground. As you know, this is our last week for the fund drive, for at least for Africa Now, but this is possibly the last week, the last day. And we had a great turnout last week, and hope we can do that this week again. And I know there are a number of people who listen to us and from all over the world. And you can go on the website as well, WPFWFM.org and scroll down to African Owl and make your pledge there for the whatever amount is comfortable for you. But we're looking for at least minimum 5 new members. And we'd like to also spread the geographical location at least one. Since we're in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, at least we should get one from D.C., the city itself, and the surrounding states, and Maryland, and Virginia, and also West Virginia, and hopefully Pennsylvania. So if we can get one from each, that'll be great. And then more than that. I don't know if Katia have any other comments.
Just that, you know, people should support that which supports them. And, you know, Mwiza, I say that a lot, and I say it, almost every program, but it really is so true. Imagine all that you've learned about the African diaspora through this program in particular, the scholars, the researchers, the journalists. You just had Estacio Bilao on talking about Mozambique, and we hear this morning about the violence that is ensuing over what is happening regarding elections there. Nowhere else do you get a weekly update on what is happening, not only on the continent, but throughout the African diaspora on terrestrial radio, except for an African Now, and even on internet radio. There is nothing like African Now, the fine job that Mwiza Mthali and James Pope do in curating and producing this program. So be in solidarity with us. Join the WPFW community. Again, we're looking for those new members to do their thing today for Africa Now. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, $500 to go. We can do this together, folks.
And we're going to go back to one of the stimulating conversations we're talking about with Dr. Kamal Rashid in conversation with Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
But specifically, you know, with respect to this Christianity, it wasn't the Christianity of certainly Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, right? You know, it wasn't the Christianity of Nat Turner or Martin Delaney. It was a pacifistic Christianity. It was a Christianity which encouraged Black folks to accept their lot in the present, to accept their subordinate status within the society. While they focused on the salvation of their immortal souls. And so certainly the hereafter was emphasized more so than the present. And for people like certainly Samuel Chapman Armstrong and others who embraced this type of gospel, literally was to nullify any type of consciousness in the masses of Black people around the actualization of another type of vision. And I want to come back to that question of vision in a little bit. The second type of ideological weaponry that was deployed was this idea, this articulation of a work ethic, a type of work ethic. You know, you find replete in the writings of that period about Black folks, and even in some of Du Bois's writings up until up to the end of the 19-teens, you know, talking about the need for work ethic for Black folks, which is fascinating. You know, you would hardly imagine that the people newly freed from plantation labor would not know how to work, but you had, and so I would argue that really the idea is really more than anything else a type of fabrication. The idea that these people, essentially, if left to their own devices, you know, are lazy, and thus they need to be taught the value of work. They need to be taught to work. They need to be taught really to toil. And then finally, the third type of ideological weaponry is this idea of less a type of ideological weaponry as much as it was a type of weaponry deployed through the mechanism of training, was the subordination of the Black masses in the labor market. You know, this is something that James Anderson writes about in his book, The Education of Blacks. And he talks about how if you look at Tuskegee, even though Tuskegee had touted itself as providing vocational education, you know, if you look at what was being taught at different points in time, it was actually out of step with what was the state of the art, you know, sort of the latest methods, latest technology, the latest trends in the industrial labor market. So in fact, these Black folks were not being educated in a way that would have, or trained in a manner that would have enabled them to be competitive with whites. They were getting something, but they certainly weren't getting something that would have allowed them to compete. And so I say all that to go back to this idea of vision, you know, and this is something that I would raise with my students. And I'll just mention this now, we can come back to it later on. But I would always ask my students, especially when we have discussions about Watkins, you know, what is Black people's vision of futurity? And what are the visions of futurity that exist in the Black community pertaining to education? Because what has been, what has happened, and we see this certainly from the 19th century to now, other people's visions of futurity have been imposed upon us. And of course, you see Black people resisting this all along the way. Certainly, this is evident in the writings of people like Anna Julia Cooper, the writings and work of people like Anna Julia Cooper, Carter G. Woodson, and especially much of what he says in Miseducation of the Negro. Du Bois, by the time you get to the 1930s, begins to, really the 1920s, if you think about it, the commencement address to David Fisk, but certainly in terms of the writings in the 1930s, he's pushing back against this. And so, like, when we come back to the HBCU and the role of the HBCU, part of, I think, part of the challenge is that while on one hand, HBCUs were established as institutions to facilitate the education of Black people, relative to where the locus of control of HBCUs was situated, they were established to a large extent as mechanisms to facilitate the control of Black people, right? Because just like I raised this question with my students in the 20 teens, that is, what are the localized visions of future, of the future, localized visions of education that exist in the Black community? These would have been pertinent questions in the 19th century. These would have been pertinent questions in the early 20th century, but certainly no one is asking Black people, hey, what kind of future do you all want? What kind of future do you envision for yourselves? Now, we certainly see enough in terms of the things that, that Black folks were doing that gives us some indication in terms of cooperative economics, in terms of things that attempt to give people self-sufficiency, you know, in terms of some of the indigenous spiritual practices. So we see certainly a lot of evidence in terms of where Black folks would have gone and left to their own devices. And this takes me to another metaphor, Dr. Anderson Thompson. He would argue that things are guided by a principle of motion. You know, he would talk about this idea that when things are governed by an internal principle of motion, they essentially grow into the thing that they would have become if left to, essentially left to their own devices, right? You know, if you could think about, you know, we farm, and, you know, if you put a plant seed in the ground, you water and take care of it, it becomes whatever kind of plant that seed produces. It's a zucchini plant, it grows to do zucchini and so on. But if I create inhospitable conditions, that thing may not become, and it may not reach the zenith of its potential, right? So, you know, too much water, too little water, too much sunlight, too little sunlight, that plant may not become the thing. And I think such is the case, and I think Dr. Anderson Thompson mentioned this, he talked about this within the context of people, that essentially we've been given a particular type of vision of education, and we've been given an institutional framework to facilitate our integration, and Marlene Baruti phrases better, our sub-integration, I actually like that better, into a particular social and economic framework that, to a large extent, appears to be incongruent. Not only appears to be incongruent with our very capacity to be self-determining. And so one of the challenges of HBCUs, and you see this at the beginning of the 19th century, in terms of this ideological conflict between Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. And I don't want to make too much of that conflict, because I know a lot of ink has been spilled about that conflict. And in fact, Dr. Jacob H. Carruthers is very dismissive of the conflict. He argues that essentially you have two Black intellectuals engaged in contestation over something that neither of them had control over. And I think that's a reasonable criticism. But to be sure, we are talking about, especially if we're talking about 1930s Du Bois, which is not the Du Bois that was in contestation with Booker T. Washington. I'm not saying that, right? But certainly 1930s Du Bois is articulating a conception or institutional framework that we control for ourselves. Now, again, he's not necessarily talking that in the 1890s, early first decade of the 20th century. But to be sure, that's what we're dealing with in terms of what HBCUs emerge as, institutions that were administered by either religious white church denominations, organizations that were largely funded by white philanthropies, by the state, by various states, and focus on not, again, providing education that would enable Black people to both envision a future of themselves and to actualize a future, but a type of education that would facilitate their, again, sub-integration into a social order that at its core is focused on white hegemony, and more specifically, you know, capitalist hegemony. I hope I got at the question that you asked.
Oh, yeah, no, you actually raised, you got me three more questions.
Okay.
but let's go back. No, absolutely, because let's go back to, because what we're talking about here is, again, it's this notion of power, this notion of knowledge, production and access, how much knowledge do
allow access to in these educational systems, in the colonial system, because I know you've had the same response by students who or anybody, students or anybody, as you're having a conversation with someone and you start to kind of unwrap or to situate the, you know, these questions that people have, not just in institutional education, but on the everyday level that we're dealing with here, is like, what are we being educated for and the processes of that, you know, which directly relates to the notion of futurity. And we were going to get there, you know, because we really want to talk about and go back to this idea that you presented or that you talked about. You, if you don't have a vision of the future, or the vision of the future is distorted based upon the conditions, you're going to be given somebody's vision of the future.
Right.
And in the context of this, there are, and we also want to be clear, because we want to talk about the contestations as well, because it wasn't that, you know, African descended people were just kind of laying down, just accepting a lot of this stuff, because there were instances that, you know, people were trying to use these systems, you know, for better or for worse. But if we're looking at this in the 21st century, we can say that we, you know, a lot of folk, we have not continued that process. But basically the question is, as you, as I was kind of laying out here, people will say, well, why don't they teach us this, right? They're not supposed to, because if we understand the processes of education, particularly as being formulated in tandem with the subjugation of the continent, the institutionalization of the subjugation of the continent, that filters itself all the way back here to, what do you do? How do you handle the question of the African or the Negro question right after the Civil War? But also this same ideological framework was what they were trying to really merge the management of the plantation economy as it's shifting to a more industrial global economy, and the means of production and the different processes and the conditions. So here lies the question: if you're no longer needed for labor, the question of the precarity or the liminal existence of HBCUs will be directly related to the philanthropy of the same ideological propensities of the colonialist folk educated from the first place.
Right.
So what I'm saying here is labor is at the center of this. What are you educating for? Because this also directly relates to students making the choices and courses of study based upon the labor market. The problem is, as I see, a lot of these choices, particularly HBCUs, are being made not in a global context of the labor market, because we have a global market. It's still at this very rudimentary, let me get a job to try to maintain and sustain. But again, this contestation, you know, and we'll talk about this. So in your answer or in your response to what I just said, let's talk about, you know, let's go back to this notion of labor being directly related to training in the education of Black education, particularly at HBCUs. But also let's move to, or let's talk about some of those contestations that leads up to the formations of Black studies, Africana studies, the formations, you know, because we do want to talk about the resistance to that as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I want to respond to that, go back to the colonial piece, because I didn't finish sketching out that continuum, right? On one hand, you have, again, relative to the Negro question, this need to create an educational system for the sake of managing Black people, right? To inculcate within Black folks a particular vision, a particular notion of the society, the social order, and their place within it, and to accept it, very much akin to what Carter G. Woodson talks about. And you have subsequent to that.
The center of questions around Black labor usually pivot on the role of Black education. However, most explorations are neither critical nor intellectually honest. Today, Dr. Kamal Rashid joins us in conversation where we meditate on Black labor and the white architects of Black education. Our thoughts are centered on William H. Watkins' work, The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power, 1865-1954. In The White Architects of Black Education,
Watkins explores the body of ideas that undergird social, economic, racial, and educational beliefs about Black education in the U.S. Therefore, it's an ideological study. His stated objective is to investigate the ideological construction of colonial Black education by examining the views, politics, and practices of the white architects that funded, created, and refined it. Supporting this approach, Watkins argues that a body of ideas serves to rationalize and justify any political or economic system, but ideology helps organize our world and explains it in relation to power and vested interests. Watkins' work highlights that the white architects of Black education represented great power and wealth. Most often, they stood for the interests of Northern capital and Southern white expediency. Therefore, colonial education in the South must never be confused with the educational agenda of Blacks in the South. In fact, these agendas conflict. The central question guiding our discussion today simply asks, how far have we moved away from these foundational ideas and their ideological grounding? Dr. Kamal Rashid is currently professor and founding director of the Urban Education EDD program at Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid earned his PhD and BA from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a Master's of Art degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African-American history and culture, particularly the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. He is co-developing an oral history and archival project focused on African-American social movements in the Chicago area from 1960s to 1980s with Dr. Richard Benson of Spelman College. And he is currently working on Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, as well as the critical theory of W.E.B. Du Bois, The Struggle for Humanity. He has published a number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, as well as received various grant awards to support his work. Lastly, and likely most importantly, Dr. Rashid is active in a number of community organizations in the Chicago area, including the Comedic Institute of Chicago, a research and educational organization focused on mapping, exploring, and applying the ancient and contemporary contributions of ancient Nile Valley civilizations.
And again, that's co-host and executive producer James Pope with Dr. Kamal Rashid. And that's from our archives. We're going to take a short break from that conversation to be in conversation further with our program director here at WPFW, Katia Stitt, who is on the line with me on the virtual studio. Hopefully, one day we'll be in the physical studio. So that and speaking of which, we are going to be moving.
That's right. And we will be in the real studio then together again. I cannot wait for that, Mwiza, to be able to see you in person, although I've seen you because you do such great work in the community. But we want to encourage people to do what Amir Woods, who is a wonderful intern that we've had, Amir Woods, Silver Spring, Maryland. She says, thank you for the work you do locally and for the world. Absolutely. They do fantastic work.
Thank you very much, Amira.
Yes, and we miss you. We hope to see you back. At WPFW.
She's doing a lot of great things in the environmental world. And
She really is. Yeah. Absolutely. So that leaves us with 4:65 to go, folks, and 17 minutes to do it. We can do this together. $465 again. If you are that listener that has not yet crossed the burning sands to make your pledge of support to WPFW and specifically to Africa Now, we ask you to do that now. We are trying to get to 600 new members between now and the end of the drive on Sunday. And we still have $593 to go. So you can make a difference right now. And you can support that which supports you. You can support this wonderful program bringing us what is happening not only on the continent, but throughout the African diaspora, these critical conversations being had, whether we're talking about the Sahel Alliance or the foundation of HBCU education. Fascinating conversation today that Dr. James Pope is having. And we know that you are listening because many of you are appointment listeners to Africa Now, as I am. So please go to the phones, make that call or that click on the computer that makes the difference. 800-222-9739, if you prefer that local number, 202-588-9739, or you can go online to WPFW wpfm.org, $465. One new member becoming a sustaining member at the $50 level will put us over the goal for today. Won't you be that person? If you've done well and you want to do something really great, not only for yourself, but for the entire community. And here we talk about the global community because we are streaming globally. And Africa Now is a global platform. So you can do something wonderful for everyone by pledging your support. And again, just putting it on your mind that you might want to consider pledging at that $50 a month level, which would put us over goal. 800-222-9739. Of course, if you have $5 to pledge to Africa Now, we will humbly and gratefully accept that. If you have $5,000, I know there are many of you listening right now that could do that easily. Please make that call that makes the difference. You make everything here possible. You provide the platform of WPFW. So such a stellar program like Africa Now and the fine producers in the body of Mwiza Muntali and James Pope can bring us this programming. You do that. You make sure this platform is available to all. 800-222-9739, $465 to go. Or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. Mwiza?
Yeah, and as you mentioned, talking about the Sahel Alliance, actually a couple weeks ago, we did feature, focused on the action against AFRICOM, which our colleagues at the Black Alliance for Peace, in the name of Nefa Freeman as well, who has a show on this station as well, Voices with Vision, every Tuesdays at 9 to 10, and the Black Alliance for Peace is having an event actually as part of the International Month Against Month of Action Against AFRICOM. That's going to be at the University of Maryland College Park at the Nyamburu Cultural Center. That is Nyamburu Leadership, it's part of the Nyamburu Leadership Series. And the title of that event is The AFRICOM and the U.S. War on Africa, Hidden from the Headlines. That's at 11 a.m. tomorrow, which is October 31st, Thursday, October 31st, that's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Nyamburu Cultural Center in College Park, Maryland, at the University of Maryland. And you can visit, I guess, the BlackAllianceForPeace.com website. That's our BlackAllianceForPeace.com website to get more information. Or you can also probably check it out on the University of Maryland Nyamburu Cultural Center. And all we need is five members maybe pledging $100 sustainer membership, and we'll be over at the mark. And as a sustainer, you can spread out the payment of $10 a month, or you can do $5 a month, and we'll reach the goal. Again, the number is 800-222-9739 or 202-588-9739. And of course, you can donate on the website wpfwfm.org, scroll down to Africa Now. And we also take Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM. Just indicate it's for Africa Now, and also your contact information, your email preferably. Katia, do you have any other information for the audience? Because this is a community event, community program, as we just announced the events in the community.
Absolutely. And, you know, also we have to lift up the incredible work that you and James do off air as well, that you bring to the air, you know, whether it be the African Diasporic Film Festival or the African Film Festival, or, you know, the lectures that you all do, the lectures that you all record and bring to our air that happen in the community. So, folks, what you're getting on the air with Mwiza Muntali and James Pope is just an extension of the good work they do around the African diaspora off of our air. And so many, this is a beautiful thing about WPFW, so many of our hosts are active in the community in that same kind of way. And then they bring that information, that knowledge base to our airwaves. This is really a university of the air that anyone can access. You don't need to be in a classroom. You don't need to be online. You simply need to have a radio, and even a terrestrial radio. Just turn it on, and here we are. And there is so much education, so much information that Africa Now gives us weekly. So again, we want to encourage those that have not pledged yet to do so. And if you've already pledged, consider making another donation. As Mwiza so eloquently put, we only need $100, five people making $100 donation as a sustainer, which is very little when you think about it. And fortunately, there are people that are privileged. We understand that is a position of privilege when you're able to make a donation to WPFW, but there are many of you listening right now that are privileged and able to do that. So please consider that gift. 800-222-9739, $465 to go. We can make this goal together, folks. We have 11 minutes to do it, or WPFWFM.org. Mwiza, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being with us. Always a pleasure to have a program director who does so many things, and you can also catch her on the air on Wednesdays. Is it every other Wednesdays now, or on Wednesdays?
Yes, every other. So next week I'll be there. Yeah, but Herb Taylor does a fine job too. So we're kindred spirits with the music. So any Wednesday you tune in, you'll get great sounds.
The Morning Brew Beyond Borders edition, and that's from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. And following us on African Now today, you have the headline news, and that's also followed by Shanana with Zain and Amin looking at the issues in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Very important show, particularly at this time, as you see the plight of Palestinians in Gaza and beyond. And Zain has been covering that so many years and bringing the voices from those areas before people were covering it, really. And Zain is also very involved in the community. And after that is the Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor. And after that is Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa. And then after that is Margaret Kimberly with Black Agenda Radio. And then Eugenia Charles brings the news from Haiti, Gombe Lakai, at 7 p.m. today. Before we go, I just wanted to acknowledge our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Olusen, and also our research fellow volunteers, Shanda Kozer and Funangonda, and of course our executive producer and co-host, James Pope, and our engineers, Michael Nacella and Kalia Chapman. We still have 4 minutes to go before the headline news, and also we have 9 minutes before the end of the hour here to make our goal. We still need to get the $500 goal. Maybe we can even get 1,000 between that and now. You never know. But because we do need, as we said, we're moving to newer place, but that takes a lot of resources. And the reason why we've been here all these years is because the community has been there continuously supporting WPFW. This is a community station, as Katia said, many hands make light work. And also in the other African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. WPFW has been literally the child of the community for 47 years. And that's the only way that you've had the station have all the varied programs, important programs covering a broad spectrum of the society, and with the music and public affairs. The full conversation that we had today will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. And again, we still have three minutes to go. We need at least $465 to go to reach the $500 mark. And I'm sure we can reach that with just five people with a sustainer support of $100. We'd spread it out throughout the year, $10 a month, or you could do $50 a month or $5 a month, whichever is comfortable to you. And we would reach the goal, and we'll make sure that the station continues to thrive, not just survive, but thrive. Again, the number to call is 800-222-9739, 800-222-9739, or 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739. And also, you can go on the website at WPFWFM.org, scroll down to Africa Now to make your donation there. That's WPFWFM.org, and go to donate up on scroll down to Africa Now. And also the website, the Cash App is the $WPFWFM, and indicate is for Africa Now, and also put your contact information. I'm Wiesel Bentali, your host, Al-Afghan Al. Have a great day. Have a great week.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Two Israeli airstrikes in northern Gaza yesterday killed at least 88 people, including dozens of women and children. The director of a hospital said injuries were going untreated because an Israeli raid over the weekend led to the arrest of dozens of medics. The humanitarian situation in northern Gaza is dire after weeks of a renewed Israeli offensive there, and after Israeli lawmakers on Monday passed two bills restricting the work of the UN relief agency, UNRWA. Meanwhile, U.S. officials and other mediators are working this week to restart talks to end the wars in Gaza and Lebanon. Two senior White House officials plan to visit Israel tomorrow, while CIA Director Bill Burns is heading to Egypt. Two officials cited by the AP said a proposal to end the war in Lebanon calls for a two-month ceasefire, during which Israeli forces would withdraw from Lebanon and Hezbollah would pull back from the border region. Lebanese officials said the plan involves boosting the number of UN peacekeepers and Lebanese troops in the border area. A separate proposal for Gaza calls for a four-week ceasefire, during which Hamas would release up to 10 hostages. That plan contains no guarantees of a permanent peace. In both cases, the warring sides still appear far apart on conditions for peace, with Hamas in Gaza demanding a full Israeli withdrawal. Separately, U.S. airstrikes hit several Islamic State camps in Syria earlier this week, killing as many as 35 militants, according to U.S. Central Command. The command said there were no indications of civilian casualties. Flash flooding in eastern Spain yesterday killed at least 72 people and disrupted transportation in the country's worst natural disaster in recent memory. Most of the dead were in the Valencia region on the Mediterranean coast. The death toll is expected to rise as rescue efforts continue. The National Weather Service reported rainfall of 12 gallons per square foot over 8 hours. Cars were swept away and homes damaged by the flooding. The Spanish government said it will declare 3 days of mourning beginning tomorrow. Over 1,000 Spanish troops were deployed to impacted areas. The Spanish flooding is reminiscent of devastating floods in Germany and Belgium in 2021, when 230 people were killed. Spain is still reeling from severe drought and high temperatures in recent years, and scientists say these weather extremes are likely linked to human-caused climate change. In domestic news, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled yesterday in favor of Virginia Republicans who asked the court to allow the state to resume its purge of voter rolls just a week before Election Day. The decision grants an emergency appeal from GOP Governor Glenn Youngkin, who has sought to purge more than 1,600 voter registrations in recent months to stop what the state claims are non-citizens voting. The court's three liberal justices dissented. Lower court judges had ruled that the state illegally purged voters. Non-citizen voting is rare in the U.S., but right-wing figures, including Donald Trump, have made it a core part of their political message. Court records show that at least some of the Virginians whose registrations were purged were, in fact, U.S. citizens. In a similar lawsuit in Alabama, a federal judge ordered the state to restore voter eligibility to 3,200 people who were deemed non-citizens. In that case, more than half the people purged from voter rolls were, in fact, U.S. citizens. And the U.S. economy grew at a healthy 2.8% annualized rate in the last quarter, driven largely by consumer spending. That rate of growth is down slightly from the previous quarter, but still high given the continued pressure of high interest rates. The Commerce Department data released today also showed positive trends in inflation, with one measure of consumer inflation rising at just a 1.5% annualized rate. That's down from 2.5% in the prior quarter and is the lowest rate in over 4 years. In a statement, President Biden said the economic data shows, quote, how far we've come since I took office, from the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, from the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression to the strongest economy in the world. For